wasn't sunken, though the lid was closed. That mangled eye bulged ever so slightly, as if it had been meant for a being considerably larger than she was. There was around her a humming throb of energy unlike anything I'd ever sensed before. A power so ancient and terrible that the world had forgotten its like. That power demanded my respect, my obedience, my adoration, my abject terror. And suddenly, I knew what was happening. I was standing in the presence of a goddess. I could barely breathe. I couldn't have moved if I wanted to. A moan went through the room, and I realized with a bit of alarm that one of the voices moaning was mine. Some part of me noted that Vatterung and Ferovax had both come to their feet, fists clenched, and they were not looking at each other any longer. Both stared hard at the woman. The goddess swept her single-eyed gaze around the room, tracking from face to face. She gave the Winter Lady a look of pure contempt and delivered exactly the same expression to the rest of the gathered accorded nations. Her voice, oh God, her voice was sex and chocolate and hot soup and a bath on a cold, rainy night. It was a voice that promised things that you could find yourself listening to with absolute intensity. It filled the room as if she'd been using a PA system, even though she wasn't.
"Children, children, children," she murmured, shaking her head in disapproval. "Our world has gone to the children." Her gaze reached Ferovax and paused. One of her cheeks ticked. She looked from the dragon to Vatterung, and when she saw him, her teeth showed white and perfect.
"One Eye, are you that involved in the game still? Are you still that arrogant? Look how far you've fallen. Consorting with insects, as if you're barely more than mortal yourself."
No one moved. No one spoke. And then footsteps sounded on the stone floor. Gentleman John Marcone stepped out from behind the unmoving guard, impeccable in his suit. He didn't look frightened, though he had to be. He simply stepped forward, clear of his guard, and said,
"Good evening, madam. I am Baron John Marcone. This is my home. Might I have the pleasure of knowing how you wish to be addressed?"
The goddess narrowed her eyes, watching Marcone with the kind of revulsion that one normally sees reserved for a swarm of maggots. She shook her head, dismissing Marcone from her attention, as she fixed her gaze on Vatterung again.
"This is your host," she demanded. "You permit a mortal among you. Where is your dignity? Where is your pride?" She shook her head. "This world has gone astray. We have failed it. And I will no longer huddle fearfully in the seas and watch the mortals turn it into their filthy hive."
The goddess walked forward, staring down at Marcone. She circled him, shaking her head in judgment. And still, no one moved. She pointed a finger at Ferovax without looking at him and said,
"Introduce me to this ephemeral."
For a few seconds, there was silence. Then Ferovax spoke in a ragged voice that sounded like it was being dragged out through his teeth.
"This is Ethneu, daughter of Balor, the last Titan."
Ethneu lowered her pointing finger. Ferovax gasped and staggered, putting a hand on the back of his chair to balance himself as he breathed heavily.
"This world has manifestly failed,"
she continued, now addressing the room.
You thought yourselves wise to band together, to live quietly, to embrace,
her lip lifted in a sneer,
civility. With the mortals that used to tremble at the sound of our footsteps.
I was trembling pretty damn hard right about then, and I still couldn't make a voluntary motion.
I have stood by, doing nothing for too much of my life, Ethneu said, pacing slowly. I have watched holy place after holy place fall to the mortals, forest after forest, sea after sea. They dare to walk where they were never meant to walk, and as they do, the divine retreats, withers, dies.
She paused for a moment, and that emerald eye landed on me like a truckload of lead, regarded me, and dismissed me all within half of a heartbeat.
They grow more numerous, more petty, more vicious. While they foul the world we helped to create, but their filth, their noise, their buildings and their machines.
She came to a stop beside King Korb and laid a hand on his shoulder, almost fondly.
This ends tonight.
She turned and strode to Vaterung. She dropped to one knee in order to speak to him eye to eye.
I remember what you were, because I respect you. I assume you have seen some redeeming value among these, she waved a hand at the room, children. And because of that respect, I offer you something I was never given, a choice.
She looked around the room.
I offer it to all of the divine here. At the witching hour tonight, we, who you thought fallen, defeated, banished, and humbled, march upon the mortal world, starting with this fetid hive around us. She smiled very slowly. Finally,
Vaterung spoke, as if someone had superglued his tongue to the back of his teeth.
Ethneu, do not do this.
She stared down at him for a moment with something almost like pity.
I remember that once you were great, she said quietly. For the sake of the being I remember, I offer you this one chance. Do not interfere. My quarrel is with the mortals. Stand aside, and there need be no conflict.
She gestured at the hole in the wall behind the high seat.
That creature cannot protect you, cannot enforce her justice. Each of the divine here must choose, abandon the mortal world, or burn with it.
Her closed eye quivered, and suddenly there was a light behind the scarred eyelid, red and pulsing through the thin skin. She leaned back her head, took a breath, and opened that eye. The eye, screaming. The scream itself threatened to deafen me by sheer volume, but it was far, far more painful than that. I could feel it press against the vaults of my mind, emotion so violent and intense that it would tear my sanity to pieces if I let even a portion of it into my head. Light erupted from Ethneu, lashing out furiously at the ceiling. Where it touched the hanging swathes of fabric, they rotted and flaked away, scorching at the edges and bursting into flame. When it touched the ceiling, there was an enormous concussion, and the dark gray stone of the castle suddenly erupted with cold blue glowing light emanating from previously unseen runes and sigils written on every surface. I could feel a surge of pressure, which might have put out my ears had it been physical, as the castle's magical defenses pitted themselves against the power of a goddess. They failed. Stone shattered to dust, and energy exploded upward through the ceiling, through the upper floor, and through the roof into the summer night. Pure, magical energy surged out with it, through the room, into the night, in a wave of such breadth and power that 5 minutes before I would have considered it impossible. Looking back, that was the moment everything started to change. Magic ran rampant into the air. It howled through the streets and alleys of Chicago. It thundered through tunnels and roadways, a tsunami of raw power. And wherever it went, the mortal world fell into darkness. Power stations exploded. Electronic devices screamed and showered sparks. Screens played diabolical images and screeched in demonic voices before dying. Cars died. Systems failed. Trains went powerless and slowed. I heard later that there were nearly 1,500 automobile collisions in that single moment, resulting in scores of deaths. Chicago fell into total darkness. I found myself on my knees sometime after, breathing hard, making pained sounds. Others were making similar noises. The lighting in the great hall hadn't changed, not when it had been firelight in the first place. King Korb and the last Titan were gone. I found myself staring at Vatterung as he fell heavily back into his chair, his expression stunned. Chapter 30. A solid quarter of a minute of stunned silence followed before Gentleman John Marcone hauled himself to his feet, looked around at the destruction and confusion in the hall, and mused,
"It would seem we have the Fomor's answer with regards to the peace process."
Ebenezer was the next one up. He looked around the room and said, "Is anyone hurt?"
"The dead, it would appear," Marcone said. He started for the high seat and offered a hand to Molly. She glowered at him but took his hand and rose with a polite nod.
He spoke in a low, intent voice that wouldn't be overheard by most of the room. "Assess Mab, please, Winter Lady." Molly stared at him for a second. Then she went over to the hole in the stone wall behind the high seat. She stared for a moment and said,
"What's on the other side of the wall?"
"Storage," Marcone said.
"On the other side of that," Molly said, and vanished into the hole. Etri and his sisters stood up together. Voices rose in a babble of confusion and anxiety. Everyone had begun to recover, and no one looked like they were happy about what was going on. My grandfather looked around, eyes searching. He leaned over to Ramirez and muttered something. The warden nodded and spoke quietly to the rest of the security team.
Carter LaChase and his ghouls got up and were heading toward the exit.
"LaChase," Marcone said in a voice that was very much meant to carry to the rest of the room.
The ghoul looked over his shoulder at Marcone.
"Where are you going, sir?" Marcone asked. LaChase pointed a finger at the hole in the rear wall. His voice was a low, rich Louisiana gumbo with some whiskey added in.
"You heard that monster. You saw what she did."
"Yes," Marcone said, his tone bored. "I also saw your signature at the bottom of the Unseelie Accords, I believe."
"And?"
Marcone's voice was mild.
"And mutual defense in the case of an aggressor nation is stipulated therein."
"Mab was the Accords," LaChase spat. "You saw what the Titan did to her."
"And so I did,"
Marcone replied.
"If she can do that to Mab, what chance do any of us have?" LaChase asked.
He looked around at the rest of the room.
"All of us signed because all of us fear Mab. Do any of you think you can stand up to Korb and Ethneu? when even Mab gets swatted down like a fly? Let this mortal throw away his short life, if that is his desire. The rest of us were doing business long before these recent accords. We can do it again quite comfortably.
Lachaise turned to leave, trailing half a dozen ghouls in the wake of his massive presence.
Are you a coward, sir? Marcone asked, his voice deadly quiet.
The ghoul whirled, light and fast for all his bulk, and a low growl bubbled across the room.
A question, sir, Marcone said, not a statement.
Tread carefully, mortal, Lachaise said. I would be pleased to use your own entrails to make sausage links.
I ask the question, Marcone said, because your next actions will show everyone here what you are, Lachaise.
Lachaise quivered, his face contorting in rage.
Actually, it started contorting from human form into something more bestial, uncomfortable crackling sounds coming from the ghoul's bulky form as his shoulders rounded and hunched and his back kinked.
Marcone's voice cracked out. You are a guest, sir, in my house.
Lachaise's eyes had already gone hideous and vaguely serpentine. His weight had shifted to take a step toward Marcone, but the words locked him into place as rigidly as bonds of steel. He looked around the room to see the entirety of the leadership of the Accorded Nations staring hard at him.
Baron Marcone is correct, Etri said. You are signatories of the Accords, as are we all. You are obligated to come to Mab's defense, as are we all.
Lachaise's jaw had extended slightly, and it made his voice a snarling, gobbling thing.
Your people are bleeding from a tussle with a mere White Court assassin, the ghoul hissed. Do you think you could challenge a titan, Etri?
Not alone,
Etri said calmly. He turned to Marcone and nodded firmly.
Svartalfheim does not make commitments lightly. We will stand in defense of this city.
Marcone returned the nod.
Fools,
Lachaise said.
This is hopeless. The enemy has been given free rein to prepare. We have mere hours to assemble our own forces, assuming the attack has not already begun. Do you think Korb means to fight fairly?
Obviously not, Marcone said, which tends to make me think that he's not invincible. Otherwise, he should simply have attacked without any of this drama. It is an attempt to destroy the Accords without firing a shot, to divide us, make us easily taken one at a time.
And the Titan, Lachaise demanded. Did you see what she was wearing?
Titanic bronze, Etri noted. An alloy beyond the skill of even my people. Only the hundred-handed ones knew its secret. He looked at Marcone and clarified. Mere physical force will never stop her. Only the most puissant of powers stands any chance of doing more than annoying her.
A problem to be overcome, Marcone said, and looked at Christos. Perhaps our clever friends at the White Council have a solution.
Christos looked at Ebenezer. The two of them traded looks with Martha Liberty and Listens to Wind, and the senior council put their heads together for a brief conference. Listens to Wind looked up from it and nodded at Marcone.
Perhaps. And, in any case, we will stand with you and summon a complement of wardens to the city's defense.
Perhaps they can do something.
Lachaise scoffed. He looked around at the rest of the room.
What does this city, this mortal, mean to any of you? I say it's better to let the Fomor expend their strength on the mortals.
Idiot, snapped Ferovax, a plume of thick, volcanic-smelling smoke rushing from his nostrils. You know the mortals as well as I do. Once you awaken them, frighten them, you anger them.
They will lash out at any supernatural threat they find. And may I remind you, Lachaise, that you do not enjoy the safety of dwelling beneath an ocean they have barely explored.
The worm is right, Vatarung said. He exchanged a nod with Faravax. We must stop Ethneu here and now. If she is allowed to sack a mortal city of this size, there will be no way to contain their rage. Blind and foolish as they are many, and full of the courage of ignorance. None of us will be able to carry on business in the face of that. And Korb and Ethneu will simply sit in their palace under the sea and laugh while the rest of us try to survive.
I don't see how all of us dying in a foolish battle isn't an improvement,
Lachaise said in an acid tone.
If Ethneu can do that to Mab, what can any of us do against her? What weapon do we have against her?
Marcone stared at Lachaise as if the ghoul were a simpleton.
Courage, sir,
the robber baron of Chicago said. Skill and will. He turned to Vatarung and said, I wish to hire the entirety of the available Ein Hajarin for a night.
I can have 500 here in the next few hours, Vatarung said.
Marcone nodded. Etri? The king of the Svartals folded his fingers into a steeple. My people are artisans, not warriors. We will fight, but our assistance in establishing defenses and providing appropriate equipment will prove a greater boon. Our armories are open to you, Baron. Marcone nodded and regarded Faravax.
Sir?
My contribution to the defenses must be subtle, Faravax said. To do otherwise would be to risk destroying more of the city than I save. He nodded thoughtfully. With Etri's counsel and consent, I will close the underworld to them, prevent them from moving through or beneath the earth. One eye? Vatarung nodded slowly, evidently tracking Faravax's line of thought.
I will close all the ways to them within the city itself. Given who they are, that will leave them only one viable avenue of approach.
The water, Marcone asked.
Aye, Vatarung said. The power is greater beneath the water. They'll be able to bore through the defenses beneath the lake.
Then we'll be able to deploy our forces against an attack from the lake, Marcone said. I will bring the full strength of my own organization here. There was a polite cough, or it would have been a polite cough if a human had been making it. Considering it came out of River Shoulder's chest, it sounded more like a small cannon going off. The Sasquatch straightened his bow tie, stepped forward, and pushed his wire-rimmed spectacles up higher on his broad nose.
My people, he rumbled, are not signatories of the Accords. Not yet. But if I understand things correctly, what is happening here has the potential to bring them harm. I will stand with you.
Ha, said Listens to Wind. His worn teeth showed in a broad smile.
Be good to work with you again, River.
River's shoulders looked toward Listens to Wind and winked. I was impressed. River wasn't the kind to rush into things, and offhand, I couldn't remember going up against anything more dangerous than one of the forest people who meant business.
What of the White Court? Ebenezer asked. Where is Ms. Wraith?
At that, there was a murmur of confusion, and then all eyes fell onto the White Court's sitting area, where only Riley was there to speak.
Ms. Wraith had matters of state to attend to, he said, his voice steady. I'll need her authorization before engaging, but I've already sent a runner with orders to bring her local forces to combat readiness. 100 guns, plus whichever members of the house are in residence at the chateau.
Communications, transportation, Marcone said. If that hex Ethneu threw was anything like what I've seen from others, and is as effective at destroying technology, we're going to have difficulty reaching everyone and bringing them together in the proper place. There was a cough from the far end of the hall, where the summer lady had been sitting quietly with her security team, including the summer knight gathered around her. Sarissa's hair had become a cloud of silken white tresses over a dress that had been leaf green before I had drunk the blending potion. She looked a scary amount like Molly, honestly, or maybe Molly looked more like her. Sarissa rose, looking intensely uncomfortable, and said,
I can help with communications. The little folk are well suited for such tasks. I would recommend the roof of this castle, I think, for a command center for easy access.
There was a rustle, and then Molly slid out of the hole behind the high seat. I've been handling transport for winter troops for some time now. I can bring more of them in, as long as I know where they will be needed.
Excellent, Marcone said. Communications are, I think, the place to begin.
As well as a centralized collection of our military assets, came a ragged voice.
Mab came out of the hole in the wall. She was broken, literally. Half her body had been crushed and mangled, as if in some kind of industrial accident. She came through the hole in the wall with jerky, too quick motions. Once more, the queen in purple and white, though coated with stone dust, her skin dimpled in dozens of places, as if it had been made of some kind of mostly rigid material that showed some hail damage. As I watched, there was a hideous crackling sound, and her broken shoulder snapped unnaturally into its socket, and then resolved into its normal pale perfection. She looked around the room, slowly. A chase avoided her gaze and looked as if he wanted to sink into the floor.
Queen Mab, Marcone said. It would be good to know what forces the Winter Court intends to commit to the city's defense.
Mab stared at Marcone for a moment in silence before she said,
I am informed by my second that as of 1 hour past, all of the forces of Winter are urgently required elsewhere. The gates are under intense attack.
I felt my stomach lurch at that. The outer gates were the ultimate boundaries of reality, way out in the far reaches of the Never Never. Beyond them was elemental chaos, the outside of creation, filled with the beings known as outsiders, who eternally hungered to break in and devour all of reality, mortal and otherwise. If the outer gates were suddenly being attacked, it meant that there was no way the timing of Ethnew's actions could be a coincidence. It meant that the last Titan was in league with the outsiders. It meant that more than a few powerful entities had evidently decided that the accorded nations had to go, and they were making their intentions known in no uncertain terms. Not everyone in the room got what was happening, but I could see who had the information to translate what Mab had said very clearly. One Eye and Ferovax, the senior council, River Shoulders, Etri, and a few others, suddenly went as pale as I felt. They understood just as well as I did what would happen if that battle was lost. Mab looked across the hall at Fix, the summer knight, a wiry little guy with a shock of white hair, the knobby hands of a mechanic, and hard eyes that were green whenever I wasn't viewing the world in monochrome.
Sir Knight, I believe Queen Titania should be informed of the situation immediately.
Then why don't you do it? Fix asked in a very polite, mild tone. Your Majesty?
She is unwilling to take my calls, Mab said. She will do as she will, but she should be informed. It is her right.
Fix frowned, but Sarissa lifted a finger and said,
"She's right. Go now."
The summer knight nodded, bowed to her, and immediately withdrew. I was impressed with that. He'd been unwilling to expose the previous summer lady to danger to a paranoid degree. Sarissa had evidently established a different dynamic to their relationship.
"Queen Mab," came Ebenezer's voice.
The old man sounded calm but respectful. Mab didn't react well to aggression, and even worse to weakness.
"If I may ask, where is the Winter Knight?"
"He was last seen consorting with Ms. Wraith," Mab said in an offhand voice.
She glanced in my direction, and her eyes suddenly became bright green and very cold.
"Rest assured, he will participate in the defense of the city as soon as he has concluded his business."
Ebenezer's jaw hardened. "Ma'am, with respect, I will need to coordinate with him. The sooner the better."
"I will send him to you,"
Mab said, turning a cool gaze to the old man. Ebenezer met her eyes for a moment and then nodded a stiff-necked acceptance.
Great. Now I had this to explain.
"Very well, then," Marcone said. "Ladies and gentlemen, if you could each send someone with executive decision-making capability with me, we will establish a command center for the city's defense."
The room stirred, generally speaking, voices rising as people started moving, and I took Mab's hint. I also had business to conclude. The evening had gone completely sideways, sure. But whatever the result of the battle, if Etri was still around afterward, he'd be after my brother. Right now, the only thing keeping him from hunting down and killing Thomas was Ethnew's major distraction, and the fact that no one had yet realized that Thomas had escaped. It had just become even more urgent that I get him clear. There was only one place that I could do that, and there was little time to do it in. Mab's instructions had been crystalline, even to me. Get it done, and get back. I headed for the door, through a sea of worried, monochrome faces, and hit the night running.
Chapter 31 Being the Winter Knight mostly sucks, but it comes with a few perks that can be damned handy. First, I'm strong. Not like Spider-Man strong, but I'm about as strong as someone built like me can be. And I'm not exactly a tiny guy. I'd gotten myself mostly dead as part of the deal, and by the time I'd gotten back to the world of the living, my body had wasted down to nothing. Part of recovery had been physical training. A whole hell of a lot of it. And since the constant primal pressure of the mantle could be safely eased through intense exercise, I'd kept it up. It didn't turn me into an instant superhero or anything, but you don't want me punching you in the nose, either. Second, I can have issues noticing pain and discomfort. Mostly that means things like cutting myself a whole lot while shaving. Sometimes when I stand up after reading for a long time, I don't notice that my leg has gone to sleep and I fall down. I have to really pay attention to notice pain, most of the time. It's probably been good for me to work on a little more self-awareness, but it isn't much fun. On the other hand, when you're doing something to which pain is a serious obstacle, like running, it can be really convenient. The average fit young person can manage about 16 or 18 miles an hour over a short distance. Top human sprint speed is about 28 miles an hour. I can't run that fast, but I can run considerably faster than average, maybe 22 or 24 miles an hour, and I can do it without slowing down for more or less as long as is necessary. So when I hit the streets, I was really moving. I knew it wouldn't take me long to reach the waterfront. In fact, my biggest worry was that I would break an ankle and not notice it until I kept running and pounded my foot to pulp. But Chicago's streets had changed. Cars had simply come to a halt, dead in their rows. There were no streetlights, no lights in buildings, no signs, no traffic lights, no nothing. People had gotten out of their cars and were standing together in small groups, nervously talking. Everyone was holding a phone in their hands. None of the devices were working. The only human-made illumination came from, here and there, emergency road flares that people had deployed as light sources. If there hadn't been a waxing moon, it would have been too dark to move as fast as I was. It was eerily silent. Chicago was a busy place. At any time of the day or night, you could hear any number of the sounds of the modern world. Radios blaring, deep bass notes from someone's tricked-out car stereo, traffic, horns, sirens, construction equipment, public announcements, tests of the emergency broadcast system, what have you. All of that was gone. The only sounds were worried voices and my running footsteps. There weren't any screams, there wasn't any smoke. Not yet. But it was coming. My God, it was coming. If Ethneu and the Fomor hit the city during the blackout, the resulting chaos could kill tens of thousands independently of whether anyone swung a blade or fired a shot. The sudden blackout had to have killed people in hospitals, in automobile collisions, maybe even in airplanes. I mean, how would I know? I couldn't see the highways. A plane could have gone down a few blocks away, and if I hadn't seen it happen, and if there weren't any fires to mark it, I'd never be able to tell from here. The Accorded Nations were preparing for all-out war. Freaking Ferovax was involved. I ran for the docks, and as I did, I realized something truly terrifying. I had no idea what was coming next. This was out of my experience, beyond what I knew of the world. The supernatural nations might have their issues, and when we fought, sometimes there was collateral damage, but for the most part, we kept it among ourselves. Old ruins, jungles, deserts, underground caverns, that was where we did most of our fighting. Not in cities. Not in the streets of freaking Chicago. I mean, my God, she'd kicked Mab through walls. Mab? Walls? Plural. Ethneu had gone through her as if she didn't exist. Creature with power like that might not be impressed by a mere 7 or 8 billion mortals. She might very well be determined to play this one old school, and a proto-god's idea of old school probably checked in around the same weight class as Sodom and Gomorrah. Before the night was out, the city would fight for its life. My grandfather and my friends and allies on the council would be in the middle of it. My God, I had to get Thomas clear of it before it got started. I had to warn people. I mean, the supernatural community grapevine would be spreading this one like wildfire, and everyone would be paying attention because I'd spread the word for everyone to keep their eyes open. But that left the rest of Chicago. 99% and then some of the city's populace would have no idea what was going on when the attack began. Like zero idea. And being initiated to the supernatural world was difficult even when it happened gently, much less when it rolled up and ripped someone's face off. About 8 million people would react with panic, with terror, with violence. And my daughter would be in the middle of it. The very thought gave my feet wings. Only two things kept me from going to her. First, where she was staying. She was a guest in the house of Michael Carpenter and under his protection. And that meant that while she was there, she had a mostly retired hero and a squad of literal guardian angels looking out for her. I don't care how badass you might be, even on the kind of scales I use, you don't want to tussle with an angel. Those beings are absolute forces of the universe, and they are freaking Old Testament. Tangling with one would be less like getting into a street fight than like getting into a fight with the street. It's difficult to picture. You're almost certain to look incredibly foolish, and however you approach that fight, things are probably not going to go your way. Maggie could hardly be in a safer place in the city than under their protection. And the second reason was my brother. I had been trying to keep cool while we executed the rescue plan, but I was terrified for him. He was in bad shape. I could not save him, exactly, but I could keep him alive on the island. That was the whole point. Out there, I had a lot more say about what happened. Out there, I could keep him shielded from tracking magic, from deadly spells, from hostile sendings, could forbid the presence of the Svartalfs and enforce it. Out there, he'd have a chance. With luck, I could save my brother and make it back to town before Ethnew and Korb did. I hated the thought, but the imminent attack ought to provide us with a damn fine distraction. We just had to get him to the island before anyone caught us. But he wasn't there yet. I rounded the last corner at my best pace, feet pounding hard against the concrete, dashed across the street, and made it to the entrance of the docks at Burnham Harbor, where the Water Beetle was moored. I flew through the gates, guided through the dark by the white paint on the stairs and floorboards of the walkway. There was no one else here, no one else trying to get away from the city. Not yet. My footsteps on the dock hammered out over the open water, loud and clear, and I didn't bother trying to be quiet. Speed was everything. I flew down the last length of dock to the boat and saw green glowing light coming from below decks and from the cabin. The Water Beetle was a worn-out little old blue water fishing trawler, pretty much a twin to the Orca in Jaws. As I slowed, panting, my footsteps got even louder, and Freitas' slim form appeared on the deck, holding a green chemical emergency light in her hand. Murphy came limping out of the cabin a second later, her P90 riding on its harness across her chest, holding a second glow light. "Jesus, Mary and Joseph, Harry," she breathed. "That blast of light, was that an EMP? "Or a hex," I said, "or both. Where's Lara?" "She took Thomas below," Murphy said, her voice tense. "He's in rough shape." I nodded and put a foot on the gangplank. "Okay, then let's..." And from behind me came a deep, warbling, throbbing hum, like nothing I'd heard before. My dad, the illusionist. I slipped the dark opal ring I'd gotten from Molly off my hand and palmed it. Then I turned. Hovering maybe 20 feet up, with his feet planted firmly on a stone the size of a Buick, was the Blackstaff Ebenezer McCoy. One hand was spread out to one side for balance, fingers crooked in a mystic sign, sort of a kinetic shorthand for whatever spell was keeping that boulder in the air. The other gripped his staff, carved with runes like mine, and they glowed with a sullen red-orange energy. His face had twisted into a rictus of cold, hard fury. Flickers of static electricity played along the surface of the stone. "You fool," he said. "You damn fool." I put my feet back on the dock. Then I knelt down and tied my shoe. "Boy," he said, "they're using you." I set the palmed ring down behind my heel, out of sight, breathed the word in barely a whisper. There was a moment of dizziness, and then I stood up and faced my grandfather. I gathered my will. The shield bracelet on my left wrist began drizzling a rain of green and gold sparks of light. The runes of my staff began to glow with the same energy. "Sir," I said, "what are your intentions?" "To salvage something out of this mess, boy," he snapped. "The jaws of the trap are already closing in. I'm going to open your eyes." His gaze flicked past me to the ship, and a flicker of electricity along the stone made a thrumming crack like a miniature thunderbolt. "The vampire's in there, isn't he?" "You haven't seen him there," I said. "You have no idea." "Don't play games with me, boy," the old man spat. "I'm not one of your new fey friends, and I'm not a lawyer." "He's working for me," came a clear, calm voice. I glanced over my shoulder to see Lara Wraith, still dressed in her party gown, standing on the Water Beetle's deck, arms akimbo. I didn't see any weapons on her. I didn't see where the dress would have allowed her to hide any weapons. But she stood there like she was ready to draw and fire, and all things considered, I would have judged it the better part of valor to assume the implied threat was valid. I worked with Mab on some visa issues some of her people were having, Lara said. She owed me a favor. He's it. The old man's gaze remained on mine for a moment, growing harder and hotter and more hostile. I saw the rage gathering behind his eyes before he moved them slowly to Lara. Vampire, he said. The Accords are the only reason I haven't relieved you of your arms and legs and kicked you into the lake. Your brother stands accused of murder. He's going to answer for that. The voice that came out of my grandfather when he said that, I'd heard it before. I'd been that voice before. I thought of ghouls buried to their necks in the earth. I thought of the savage satisfaction that had filled me while I did it. Because they had done wrong, and I'd seen them do it to children. And to deliver just retribution for that crime had been to be the right arm of the Almighty himself, to be filled with pure, righteous, unarguably just hatred. My God, I knew how he felt. I knew how bright and pure that fire burned. But when it was happening, I hadn't been able to feel it burning me. I just had to live with the scars afterward. The vampires of the White Court had hurt my grandfather to the heart, and he was determined that it would not happen again, and that they would pay for what they had done. If Mab had been standing there advising me, she would have said something like, "It is his weakness. Use it against him." And she wouldn't have been wrong. Ebenezer glared his hatred at Lara, and I realized with a sinking heart that there was only one way this was going to play out. His eyes were full of hate. It made him blind. There wasn't room in them for anything else. "Cast off," I said in a calm, firm voice, my eyes never leaving my grandfather. "Go ahead with the plan. I'll catch up." "Dresden?" Lara asked. "Are you sure?" "Damn it, Lara," I said, exasperated. I checked over my shoulder in time to see Murphy step up beside Lara, catch her eye, and nod firmly. "Freydis," Lara said. The Valkyrie moved for the ropes. "Do that," Ebenezer called, "and I'll sink this boat right now." "No," I said calmly, firmly. I swallowed and faced the old man. "You won't." The old man's brows furrowed, and the air suddenly became as brittle and jagged as broken glass. "If I let you do this," the old man said to me, his voice desperate, "you're out of the council. You're an outlaw. The Svartalfs won't care about who hired you. They'll know you prevented them from having justice, and they'll kill you for it. It's the only outcome their worldview will accept. Don't you see, boy? You'll be vulnerable, compromised. Mab and this creature, they're isolating you. That's what abusers do." My heart broke. "I think," I said quietly, "that I'm just about done making my choices based on your mistakes." He stared at me. "You don't know me," I said quietly. "Not really. You haven't been there for most of it. And you don't know Thomas." Behind me were two quiet thumps, as lines were dropped on the deck of the ship. "I know enough to know a frog with a scorpion when I see one," he replied. "You've been around them for a decade and change, and you think you know them. But I've dealt with their ilk for centuries. They'll turn on you, frog, even if it destroys them. They don't get a choice about it. It's what they are." Lara stared at the old man with furious, haunted eyes. Murphy strode into the wheelhouse and started the water beetle's ancient engines. It was an old diesel, didn't even have spark plugs. Hexes, EMP, none of it mattered. If a one-eyed, palsied squirrel was all you had to do maintenance, that engine would run until its molecules decayed into their component atoms. Ebenezer's eye flickered to the ship and hardened. I sucked in a breath, ready to unleash power. My God, was this really about to happen? Was the old man really about to throw down with me? He wouldn't listen. Stars and stones, I couldn't get him to accept that a White Court vampire might be partially human. If I told him that Thomas was his grandson, he would not receive the news well. The old man had a volcanic temper. That wasn't a metaphor. If that happened, I really wasn't sure what came next. The water beetle's engine didn't roar so much as sputter and cough loudly to life. Compared with the almost silent murmur of the water against the docks and the ships, the sound was deafening in the unnatural silence over the city. Ebenezer McCoy snapped his staff across his body, held vertically, a duelist's salute. My heart lurched into overdrive. I returned my grandfather's salute with my own staff. And then me and the old man went to war. Chapter 32. Some free advice for you. Never fight an old man. They've been there, done that, written the book, made and starred in the movie, designed the t-shirt, and they've got no ego at all about how the fight gets won. They never fight family. They know you too well. Ebenezer slashed his hand down at the boulder beneath him with a word, and in the same spell a blade of unseen force slashed a 300-pound section of rock free of the boulder he stood on and sent it zipping toward my boat at several hundred feet per second. I wasn't even going to try to stop it. It was just too much energy, too much momentum. It would be like lifting a medieval shield to block a descending war maul. Sure, you can do it, but if you do, you're going to wish you hadn't. No. The smart thing to do is to give that war maul a single sharp lateral tap just as it begins its forward momentum. A few pounds of pressure in the right place at the right time are often more effective than expending heroic levels of energy. And besides, if I tried to match the old man's swing for swing, he'd bury me. Not so much because he was stronger, although he was, but because he was better than me, more energy efficient, milking twice the efficacy out of every single spell while expending half the energy to do it. Wizard fights between the old and the young were a reverse image of mundane confrontations between the same. I was the one who was weaker, slower, limited in what moves I could attempt, and had to play it smart if I wanted to win. So, as the old man sent the section of boulder at the water beetle, I lifted my staff, modifying the formula of my simple force blow spell to send it in from the side instead of straight ahead, and smacked the projectile firmly in the flank as it got moving. It streaked forward at an angle, wobbling and tumbling as a result, and smashed into one of the boats farther down the dock, plunging through the hull and part of the deck, straight on through the hold and out the other side, with such force that water splashed 100 feet. The old man brought his boulder around in a swooping arc, studying me through narrowed eyes, his voice bitter. Now you learn you don't have to swing for the fences every time. Yeah, I said, studying him right back. The cleave mark where the boulder had been cut was a slightly darker gray than the surface. Living rock, with water still inside then. Don't tell anybody. You'll ruin my maverick rep. He looked from me to the water beetle, chugging out into the open lake. But you still ain't using your brain. And he flicked a wrist and started sailing over me, out over the lake toward the boat. The second his eyes were off me, I unlimbered my blasting rod from the sewn pocket inside my suit coat, aimed for the damp stone of the boulder, and shouted, "Fuego!" Green-gold fire lanced from the blasting rod and smashed into the boulder, and I poured it on in a steady stream. The boulder beneath my grandfather's feet began to let out a kind of hissing, whistling scream, and the old man flung himself off it into open air half a second before the water in the stone began to boil and shattered it into dozens of pieces. Some plummeted into the lake, and some onto and through the decks of more of the boats parked in the marina. That should have been it. The old man should have fallen into the lake, become immersed in deep water, and had the lion's share of his power washed away for a time. But instead, he barked a pair of words, hurling a blast of force at the surface of the lake that pushed back just as hard against him. He was flung to one side, falling toward the dock. He hurled a second, weaker blast at the dock, slowing his fall without shattering it, and landed with one foot stomping down so hard that I heard the board crack, dropping to one knee for balance, his staff still held in his hands, his pate gleaming, his eyes bright. Hell's bells, he was better than me. That was Ebenezer McCoy, the Black Staff, the most feared wizard on planet Earth. Without pause, the old man's staff struck the boards of the dock, and they bowed up in a straight line coming toward me, as if an enormous shark was swimming toward me beneath the dock, its dorsal fin bumping up the wood. I slammed my staff down and vaulted over the oncoming wave of energy as it passed, and as I came down, I beckoned the winds, focused my will, and shouted,
"Ventas Arctis!"
At my command, the air stirred, and gale winds suddenly lashed the surface of the lake with vicious, frozen spite. A miniature cyclone of spraying ice and water engulfed the end of the dock around the old man, clouding him from sight. As fog billowed out from the sudden temperature change in the sullen night air, and while it blinded him, I did the last thing wizards generally do in a duel. I sprinted right at him. I crashed through the sleet and frozen air and ice as if they weren't there at all, spotted the old man when I was 5 feet away, and let him have it with a swift, speeding thrust of my quarterstaff, aiming for his gut. But the old man had learned his quarterstaff in Britain, long enough ago that it had still been a common weapon in widespread use, and his teachers had been masters. His own staff caught mine in a parry, and he followed it up with an advance and a circling sweeping motion that would have taken my weapon out of my hands if I hadn't disengaged properly. He came at me in a blur of attacks. If we'd been on solid ground, he'd have knocked my punk ass out cold. But now we were standing on intermittent patches of sleet and ice, and while his feet slipped and faltered, mine just seemed to always find the ideal footing. The conditions provided just enough hesitation in his forward motion that I was able to retreat a little faster until I could use my reach to good advantage, stop his advance, and with a quick snapping combo Murphy had taught me, put him on his back foot. He shifted his grip on his staff, both hands at shoulder width, and raised it defensively as he came in on me like a bull. He didn't have any choice. He could probably defend against me forever, but as long as I had the footwork advantage, I'd be able to swing at him while he couldn't reach me in reply. If he diverted his attention to summon the energy for a spell, I'd be able to feel it coming, and I'd brain him. So his only option was to come at me hard. I had a brief shot at his head when his foot slipped a little, but I was too slow to take it. Or maybe I just didn't want to. He caught it on his upraised staff, and then there was a whirlwind of blows coming at me from both sides and all angles. I defended, barely. If my foot had slipped once, the old man would have made me pay for it. He almost nailed me twice anyway, and only the treacherous footing he had to endure gave me time enough to manage a defense. You know, or maybe he just didn't want to either. But he drove me back up the dock, forcing me out of the miniature freeze I'd laid on him. Once he had his feet under him again, I wasn't going to do very well. I checked the progress of the water beetle as it chugged out of the harbor. It had 100 yards lead now. So, yeah, this was the right time. Ebenezer's foot slid off the last patch of ice, and he promptly threw a stomp kick at the bridge of my left foot as he came in. I avoided that, but it put me off balance, and the old man's staff hit my shoulder with enough force to shatter concrete. Molly did good work. There was a flash of light from the spider silk suit, the scent of something putrid burning, and instead it merely felt like getting smacked by a particularly proficient little leaguer. I cried out in pain and staggered back. "Don't make this anything it doesn't have to be, Hoss," my grandfather said, his voice hard. His next blow hit my right foot, and evidently Molly hadn't specifically enchanted the shoes, which the old man had probably been able to sense. The strike wasn't as strong as it could have been, but it broke toes, flashes of vicious, stabbing heat that quickly vanished into the rippling chill of the winter mantle, and I staggered to a knee. The old man stomp-kicked me in the center of the chest, driving the wind out of my lungs with a sickly gasp and slamming my shoulder blades in the back of my skull against the dock. Ebenezer shoved the end of his staff against my Adam's apple with a snarl and said, "Yield!"
"No,"
I croaked. The old man's eyes widened.
"Damn it, boy, you are about to make me angry."
"Go ahead," I said, baring my teeth.
"Do it. Kill me, because that's what it's going to take."
His jaw clenched, and he slowly bared his teeth.
"You arrogant, foolish, egomaniacal drama queen."
"I'm not the one who flew in on a baby mountain," I complained. He shoved the staff a quarter inch forward.
"Glurk,"
I said. His face was red, too red. The veins stood out sharply in his head, his neck. And the ground was shaking. I could feel it through the dock. When he spoke, his voice came out in a register so calm and measured that it completely terrified me. If he was doing that, it was because he was employing mental discipline techniques to contain his gulp, rage.
"I will ask you a question," he said. "You will answer me clearly and honestly. Nod if you understand."
I nodded.
"Glurk. How did they get to you, boy?" he asked, his voice still unnaturally calm. "What do they have on you? It can't be so bad that I can't help you get out of it."
His eyes softened just for a second.
"Talk to me."
I glanced down at the end of his staff.
"Ah,"
he said, and took the pressure off. I swallowed a couple of times. Then I croaked.
"They don't have anything on me."
His eyes went furious again, and tears formed in them. "Oh, God."
"Then why?" he demanded. The calm in his voice was fraying. "Why are you doing this? Why are you destroying yourself for that thing?"
I knew exactly what I was about to do. But he deserved the truth. Had to have it, really. "Because I've only got one brother," I said, "and I'm not going to lose him." The old man went very still.
"Mom," I said in a dull, flat voice.
She gave each of us one of her amulets, with a memory recorded on them, so we'd know each other. Ebenezer's mouth opened and closed a few times. "Half-brother, technically," I said, "but blood, all the same. He's got my back, I've got his. That's all there is to it." The old man closed his eyes.
"You're saying that pig wraith with my daughter?"
The ground shook harder. The surface of the lake began to dance, droplets flying up. "Sir," I said, trying to keep my voice calm, "you have a second grandson." If I'd punched him, I don't think I could have staggered him more. He fell back a step. He started shaking his head. I sat up.
"Look, whatever happened, it's over now. Thomas didn't have anything to do with that. But he has saved my life on multiple occasions.
He is not your enemy, sir. I blinked my eyes a couple of times. He's family. And the night went still. Family, came the old man's voice, a primordial growl lurking in it. One of those things. He whirled toward the retreating boat, barely visible from the shore by now, and his staff burst into incandescent blue flame as he lifted it in his right hand, the hand that projects energy, drawing it back. No! I shouted and lurched toward him. He spun, eyes surrounded by white, his face scarlet, his teeth bared in a snarl, snapping his staff out. And what looked like a comet about the size of a quarter, blazing like a star, leapt from the staff, like some kind of bizarre random static spark, and plunged into my ribs and out my spine. I tumbled down to the dock on my back. The stars suddenly unusually bright above me. I tried to breathe. Nothing much happened. Ah, God, the old man whispered, his breath creaking. His staff clattered to the dock. It sounded like it came from very far away, he said. Harry? His face appeared at the end of a little black tunnel. Oh, lad, he said, tears in his eyes. Oh, lad, didn't think you were going to come at me again. Didn't think it would trigger. I could feel his hands on my face distantly. That's why you're so big on teaching me control, I slurred dully. You're barely holding it together yourself. I'm a hot-headed fool, he said. I'm trying to help you. You knew you were losing it, I said weakly. And you kept going anyway. You could have backed me up. Blood came out of the hole in my chest in rhythmic little spurts. And instead, it ends like this. Shame touched his eyes, and he looked away from mine. The pain we feel in life always grows. When we're little, little pains hurt us. When we get bigger, we learn to handle more and more pain and carry on regardless. Old people are hands-down champions of enduring pain. And my grandfather was centuries old. This pain, though, this hurt him. This broke him. He bowed his head. His tears fell to the dock. Then he paused. Then his expression changed. He looked up at me. His eyes widened, and then his face twisted into rage and disbelief. Why, you sneaky! Good talk, I said, Wizard McCoy. And I let go of the winter glamour Lady Molly had crafted for me. I felt my consciousness retreating back down that black tunnel, down to where I had laid Molly's opal pinky ring on the dock, while I felt the ultimate construct of glamour, my doppelganger, collapsing and deflating into ectoplasm behind me. My awareness rushed into the stone in the ring, found the thread of my consciousness I'd bound to it, and then went rushing swiftly back toward my body. My eyes flew open, and I was on the deck of the water beetle, on the far side of the cabin from where Ebenezer had been, where I'd taken cover after dropping the ring and beginning the illusion. Once I'd activated the ring, the veil around me had let me slip aboard the water beetle, take cover, and then project my consciousness back into the construct. I'd blown up my relationship with my grandfather by remote control. But at least I hadn't taken a comet to the lung. As I came all the way back into my body, I was gripped by a weariness so intense that it was its own entirely new form of pain. I could feel myself thrashing in spasms. Murphy had one of those face masks with a rubber pump over my mouth and was forcing air in. Freitas was trying to hold me down. I fought for control of my body and eventually reasserted it, sagging down to the deck in utter weariness. Freitas
lay half across me, panting. Murphy, all business, peeled back one of my eyelids and shone a light on my eye. Harry, can you hear me?
Yeah, I said, and brushed the mask off my face.
Ugh. Oh, it's Bodkin, Sidemata, Freitas breathed. She rose off me wearily. You cut that one close. What the hell is she talking about? Murphy asked. A construct, I said, for the illusion. Molly made a really, really...